Good evening, everybody. Welcome. I hope Angela can join us. She's working long hours. Haven't heard, so maybe she's still in her truck. But if she comes, we'll certainly get her on the screen. We're going to talk about police brutality and killings tonight with Ernesto Ayala. And I will introduce him in a minute because turns out it's a timely topic today. The Chauvin case was decided. He's guilty on all three counts. That's the right verdict. But I don't think we should be satisfied because the system hasn't changed, which produces systematically police brutality and killer cops. So that's what we're going to talk about tonight. The other thing I want to comment in the news about today is that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ed Markey reintroduced their non-binding resolution for a Green New Deal, which is almost word for word what they introduced in the last session. In fact, the only change I could find is they changed the date for when they talk about 40 to 60% carbon reductions from 2030 to 2031. So it is still a watered down, diluted version of what the Green Party has been championing since 2010. It doesn't ban fracking and oil and gas pipelines and all the new fossil fuel infrastructure like the Green Party's plan does. It doesn't phase out nuclear power. It doesn't put deep cuts on the military to help pay for the Green New Deal and also get all that brain power that's now devoted to weapons of mass destruction to build clean energy, scientists, technicians, engineers, and so forth. And then it extends the deadline for zero emissions, which they call net zero emissions, which is a slippery term. People like Biden want to get to net zero by having carbon capture and storage attached to cement factories, steel factories, coal and gas fired power plants, which is not ending fossil fuel emissions. And so they extend that to 2050 net zero, when we said zero emissions by 2030. And we say that because that's what the climate science says we got to do. So, you know, they got a headline for that. And they kind of posture it's a non-binding resolution. When they introduced it last time, Pelosi never let them vote on it in the House. And in the Senate, McConnell said, oh, we'll have you vote on it because half you Democrats are running for president and we want to get you on the record. So Markey and Schumer said that was a trick. And so they told their members of the Democratic conference to vote present. And all of them did so obediently, except for four of the Democrats voted no on this non-binding watered down resolution for a Green New Deal with the Republicans. So I guess you could say I'm not optimistic about this making much of a contribution. I'm more concerned that it's watering down what we need to do. And I've mentioned on some of these podcasts that I'm working on an article on Biden's American Jobs Plan, in which is embedded what he's going to do about climate and the physical infrastructure of clean energy. And I've completed that. I'm going to wait a couple of days, see what comes out of this climate summit he has Thursday and Friday. But I can tell you one thing. He is going to announce that the goal of the United States is to cut carbon emissions by 50% by 2030. And I can tell you from the plan he's put out there, there is no way they're going to get anywhere close to that. So you got to look at what they do and not just what they say. And so, you know, we're in a climate emergency, but they're not acting like it. So that's really all I got to say about current events, except now we're going to talk about police brutality, misconduct, and the criminal justice system and the policing system with Ernesto Ayala, who should pop up on the screen here in a minute, and I'll tell you a little bit about him when you can see him. There he is. Hi, Ernesto. So Ernesto, like me, is from California. He grew up in Southern California. I'm from Northern California. Poicoma in the San Fernando Valley down there in Southern California. And he grew up in the Chicano liberation struggle. Participated in the La Raza Unida Party, MECHA, which is, I'll do it in English, the movement of I forget what these students for Chicano, what's the A stand for?
Aztlan.
De Aztlan.
Yeah.
And that was the Chicano student movement, is the Chicano student movement. He also participated in the Brown Berets. He was a union organizer with SEIU for 10 years. And he's recently gone back to school at Cal State Northridge, and he's about to get his BA in Chicano Studies. So welcome, Ernesto. And I know you have some comments on this whole issue of policing. So let's hear them.
Yeah, well, thank you, brother. Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for having me on the show. Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, we're seeing these events play out in the country, you know, and as Chicanos, quote unquote Latinos, we're called, you know, but we call ourselves Chicanos, Chicanos Mexicanos, you know, La Raza, indigenous people, you know, police brutality and, you know, this violence perpetrated by the United States against people is nothing new to us, you know, and part of, you know, the reason, you know, is that I'm here to talk, you know, is about how, in regards to us, you know, the whole story is basically erased, you know, and our experience with the United States, you know, our relationship with the United States is almost completely taken out of the national conversation, you know. And, you know, the interesting thing, though, is that, you know, our introduction to the United States was via military invasion, you know, and so our dealing with, you know, police or military violence is something that we've experienced from day one. You know, one, obviously, as indigenous people, you know, when the United States first even came upon our shores, or you know, Columbus and, you know, all the European invaders came upon our shores, but specifically as Chicanos, Mexicanos in the Southwest, what we call Aztlan, you know, it was through military invasion, a war, you know, that was forced upon us. And after that, you know, when the treaty was signed in 1848, you know, we were subjected to extreme brutal violence. For example, in Texas, one of the most known episodes of our history regarding that, you know, was the formation of the Texas Rangers. And the Texas Rangers were a police force. You know, many of them, you know, came from, obviously, from the East, you know, former slave catchers, former murderers of our indigenous relatives. And they were formed here in the Southwest, and in this case, starting in Texas, specifically to combat and put down Mexican and Native resistance. Sometimes that Mexican Native resistance was there was hardly any difference between it, you know, because we're the same people. So you know, that's our introduction to the United States. But like, that whole story is completely taken out of the national consciousness, you know. And you know, there's several other instances of this, you know. There was lynchings in Texas, you know, lynches in California, you know, Arizona, New Mexico, everywhere there's, you know, Chicanos, Mexicanos, lynchings, and, you know, they went in the thousands, massacres, you know, they murdered hundreds of people, including women and children and elderly people. Again, never told, not even to us living here. You know, then there was other cases, you know, for example, there was, what they called the Zoot Suit Riots, but really it was the Sailor Riots, particularly in Los Angeles, here in Los Angeles. My grandfather was a part of that. You know, he was a Pachuco. You know, this was the epic or the time period where, you know, Chicano youth, they started, you know, dressing in a certain fashion, speaking in a certain way, and identifying as Chicanos, you know, and this became a threat to the authorities. And, you know, they, you know, Chicano youth were, you know, no surprise, you know, even especially, you know, in the context of Adam Toledo and police violence, you know, Chicano youth were scapegoated for, you know, for crime and for, you know, all sorts of social ills. And the LAPD and sailors actually organized squads to beat and attack Chicano youth, rape young Chicanas, you know, and they went into neighborhoods, especially in East Los Angeles, in bands, in, you know, cars and caravans, to attack, you know, our community. And we resisted them. We fought back, you know. So you had, you know, it wasn't only, you know, one-sided. We did defend ourselves, you know, but that was, you know, another example of you know, police and legalized violence. And, you know, the police would stand by and allow sailors to beat, you know, Chicano youth, or to do horrendous things to the young women, you know, and, you know, and then they would tear off the clothes and beat them and leave them bloodied on the floor, and the police would do nothing, you know, and they're, you know, they would be just lying on the floor, and then they get arrested. You know, so this is our history, you know, and, you know, when the Chicano movement, you know, came out, you know, during the 60s and 70s, and, you know, it exploded on the scene. You know, we were also subject to COINTELPRO. We were also subject, you know, to violent repression. You know, the Chicano moratorium is one of those greatest examples. You know, it was the largest non-white demonstration against the Vietnam War and in solidarity with the Vietnamese people in their resistance to the empire. And it was repressed viciously by the sheriffs and the LAPD. And as a consequence of that, in August 29th, 1970, there was three people that died. Two of them basically died combating the sheriffs, defending the community, Lynn Ward and Angel Diaz. They were Brown Berets. And the third person, who's the person that's most known for that historical day, was Ruben Salazar, who was a journalist. And he wrote for the LA Times, and he was the head of the of KMEX channel 34, which today is like one of the biggest, probably the most watched channel in Los Angeles, Spanish language media. You know, he was shot in the head with a tear gas projectile. So imagine that. And the police officer, you know, that did that, never saw a day of jail time or anything. You know, and that was just that instance. You know, there was you know, before and after that, there was other, you know, confrontations with the police. Again, my father was there as well. After that, you know, the war on drugs. You know, the war on drugs is usually in the crack cocaine epidemic is usually told to us as if it was, you know, this binary. Just as basically all of U.S. history is told to us as if it's, you know, this binary. You know, but it's something that heavily impacted and has been impacting, you know, the Chicano Mexicano, you know, raza community. You know, as a matter of fact, here where I live in Pacoima, you know, it is the place where the LAPD first used that, you know, that tank battering ram. And, you know, they would use it throughout LA to, you know, ram down doors and just run in there and arrest or shoot whoever was in there. You know, Pacoima was the first place they did that. And my own organization that I belong to, you know, and that, you know, my father was one of the founders here in San Fernando and Pacoima, La Raza Unida Party, this chapter, they were spied on. You know, this was through the COINTELPRO program, and the PDID program, which involved the San Fernando Police Department and the Los Angeles Police Department spying on La Raza Unida Party when all they were doing was, you know, trying to provide basic necessities and political representation for Chicanos Mexicanos, you know, for our people, you know. So, you know, police violence is part of life, you know, it's a part of life, but it's something that we're never able to talk much about, you know, but it's been there, you know, and it's again, it's part of life, you know, and it's something that's always been there. It's one of the reasons we organize, you know, because of the police's the role they play in our communities. So the same role they play on the reservation, the same role they play in the ghetto with our African sisters and brothers, you know, is a role of an occupying force, you know, to enforce the rule, enforce the law of the occupier, of the capitalists, you know, and make sure that the colonies, you know, the people, the poor, the workers are in line and doing as they're supposed to be doing. You know, and this is, you know, how we were able to understand, you know, our reality, you know, and not fall into these, you know, this thinking that we just blame, you know, basically we repeat white supremacist myths and we blame ourselves when we're caught in one of these situations, you know, and, you know, for example, we're seeing, you know, what's going on with or what happened to this child, Adam Toledo, 13-year-old Chicanito. you know, shot cold-blooded by the police, and his hands were up. And it's the, you know, you have this, the same thing that happened with, you know, those, the way they were trying to depict George Floyd, like, you know, oh, he was, you know, on something, oh, he was resisting, oh, he was causing crime, you know, trying to justify, you know, basically a lynching, you know, a murder, you know, and you know, that's part of life for ourselves as well, you know, but it's, again, it's something that, you know, we're trying to put out there as well, because this is, it's not just an issue that affects one community, it affects many communities, and what we call the internal colonies of the United States, and all, you know, working class and oppressed communities, you know. So, yeah, you know, I mean, that's part of what we're seeing right now. We're starting to see more of it, you know. Sadly, because, you know, what happened to this child, Adam, was filmed, you know, and I saw that video once and I couldn't see it again. And I had no idea it was going to be that graphic. You know, but being a father myself, you know, it's caused a lot of emotions to a daughter who's the same age, you know, a lot of emotions and anger, you know, because we do hold that anger inside of us, you know, and that's, you know, one of the reasons that we organize. But yeah, you know, I mean, that's, you know, I think part of the story that is not told out there, you know, we're trying to bring light to that.
Right, Ernesto, thank you. You know, what I thought you said that people should really grasp is that Chicanos have been left out of the national narrative. And people are learning more and more about the oppression and exploitation of African Americans, the story of what happened in the Southwest, and everything that was done to African Americans was done to Chicanos. You know, the super exploitation of labor, the segregation of schools and housing, and the police brutality and lynchings. That's something that people have to understand. And particularly here in the East where I am now, I came up in California, I had a better feel for that. You know, in some of these Eastern cities, it's like the only people that there are Black or white. And, you know, it's not just Chicanos that are minorities, they're Asians and Arabs and other people, a lot of immigrants, but that missing narrative, I think, is really important. And, you know, for the Green Party, I think we talk about third parties, and most Greens know nothing about La Raza Unida, which had a lot of success in the early 70s, electing people in, you know, majority Chicano communities, particularly in Texas. And, yeah, COINTELPRO went after them. So I think, you know, that's a history that people need to understand. To understand where we are now. You know, I coming up in California, just one story. You know, when I came up, it was working class community, a mix of Black folks and Chicanos and Asians and white folks. And when I was back there campaigning this time, and I stopped off in different communities, they're more segregated. I mean, I spent a week in East LA. I never saw another white person. I saw a couple of Black folks, some South Asians that had stores or hotels, but that was about it. Stopped off in another community in the Bay Area, all Asian. I went into a gas station and a grocery store, everybody's Asian. And then, you know, I was in Orange County, everybody's white. So we seem to be going backwards in some respects.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, yeah, like you're saying, you know, there's a lot of history there, you know, and you know, one of the things that we as Chicanos that we've come to understand is, you know, we can't depend on you know, those in power to, you know, have a conscience. You know, they're not going to have a conscience. You know, they're perfectly fine with the way things are. So we've taken it upon ourselves. You know, we always have historically taken it upon ourselves to tell our story, you know, and, you know, I think that's, you know, I really appreciate, you know, you know, talking or mentioning La Raza Unida Party, because, you know, I think it's one of, you know, I mean, in general, Chicano history is hidden. But, you know, the fact that we were able to organize our own political party, And they had, a lot of victories, despite the repression. There's a lot that we could all learn from there, what other people have done, regarding organizing third parties or movements for liberation, and again, but it's something that we've taken it upon ourselves, because none of that is in the books at all. I mean, there's books about it, but, it's nothing that's being taught to our children, sometimes not even being taught in the universities,
Yeah, and I'm thinking on the narrative, and then we'll get to this question. Like the liberal corporate media,
yeah.
MSNBC. I have yet to recall hearing anything about the history of Chicanos or what they're going through. They'll usually say black and brown, and brown is basically all the other people of color. So that particular history, which is so significant, it's like a quarter of the United States that was taken over in the what we call the Mexican War. So people are just aren't getting that. So we had a question come up. So Dig Doug asks, Mr. Ayala's thoughts on abolish/defund and Howie's. And two, is abolition a precursor or part of or a result of a revolutionary socialist program?
Well, I mean, like any reform that would, help or be positive, of course we're going to support it. What I would say, that we are for, and maybe that's even part of it, but that we, I think should be one of the things that we think about is, if there's going to be a police force in our communities, we're not saying we don't want police. But we don't want, these occupying forces, and obviously if we're in the United States and living, in this present reality, any police force that they have is going to be an occupying force. Any police department that they have is going to commit atrocities, is going to murder people, is going to beat people, is going to abuse of its power, because that's their role. It's not a mistake. For us, we believe, if there's going to be a police force, we have to organize our own police force. We have to be in power of whatever happens in our communities, because we can't depend on the occupier. We can't depend on the ruling class to do anything that's actually going to be in our favor and or say that they will and keep their word, yes, yeah, we want to fund the LAPD, all these police, of course, and they're, put that money into other programs, definitely. We want the, but we do want these in like they say in Spanish, in resumidas cuentas, we want these police completely gone from our communities, completely gone. And if there's going to be a force that and a law that is upheld, it's going to be something organized by our very own community, not from the outside, but from within, and enforce, whatever we agree upon that is in our best interest, not someone from the outside that lives on the other side of the of town and goes into work in some government building and decides for us. We have to decide for ourselves, Do we have, do we think that there's people that should be in jail? Yes, it's usually the people that are presently putting people in jail that should be in jail, and all these police that commit these crimes, there should be no question. I mean, what happened to George Floyd, obviously this murderer should have been in prison right away. Had he not been a police officer, had he been African himself or Chicano, brown, he would have been in jail a long time ago, But these guys, they because of the role that they play, they have all this protection, they're obviously going to have that protection, And I think that should make us understand, what we need to do to get there, I think the verdict, today's verdict kind of shows us that, you know, and we need to understand that, you know, had the rebellions not happened last year, you know, these historic rebellions, they weren't just protests and demonstrations. They were rebellions. You had people in the streets engaging the police in combat. You had people, you know, revolting and rebelling because they were upset. You know, they were resisting. And, and some of the images we saw on TV or people that were probably at some of these events, you know, it looked like the country was on the verge of something else, you know. But that's why this verdict came down. That's why they ruled, you know, to put this disgusting Derek Chauvin guy in jail. Finally, it's not because they have a conscience. It's not because they all of a sudden they said, oh, you know what, this is the right thing to do. You know, maybe Mr. Floyd didn't deserve to be killed in this way. No, it was because they saw the force. They saw the anger that was in those streets. They saw the righteous anger of the African black people, you know, take to the streets and say that they've had enough and that they were willing, many of them willing to give the most ultimate sacrifice, their lives, to make that a point. Some people actually did. Last week, you know, if we follow those events, you know, so, you know, that's what made this happen. You know, it wasn't, you know, because it was the right thing to do. It was the right thing to do to put him in jail, but it's because they saw the power behind it. They feared that what happened last year could happen again, and this time around, you know, with a lot more direction. Most likely, if it would have happened.
Well, I would say in relation to a revolutionary socialist program, I mean, that's a program not to take over the state as it is, but to transform it. And you can't just put a new police chief in or set up a review board that, you know, maybe subpoenas and get some information and advises the police chief on discipline. It's not community policing where the officers walk the beat and get to know the neighborhood. That may be good in itself, but the problem is the police themselves. So when there's a murder or an assault or corruption, they cover it up. Now, this case was so obvious. It was on videotape. The whole world saw it. It was a murder and everybody saw it. I mean, it wasn't a question. But in most cases, it's not videotaped. And if it is, there are ambiguities and the system is very reluctant to deal with cops. We had the case of Eric Garner in New York City, suffocated to death. And he was put in a chokehold in 2013 that had been banned by the New York Police Department since 1993. So this officer killed Eric Garner and was never disciplined by the New York Police Department. That's the problem. We can't let the police themselves. What we got to transform is policing. And that's why, you know, Angela and I were campaigning on community control of the police, the old Black Panther program. You know, when they did the referendum in Berkeley in 1970, they had a poster and it asked, pigs or policemen? And the question was, you want these oppressive cops that are, you know, mistreating us, or you want policemen that serve the community? And when it comes to abolition and defund, I think for a lot of grassroots people, I live in a predominantly Black community. You know, when they hear that, they're like, well, then who's going to solve this kid's murder, you know, or a missing child? You want detectives, you want people to do investigation and get the people. That's what the police should be doing. Now, there are a lot of things they should not be doing, you know, giving vagrancy charges to the homeless instead of a home, or a drug charge instead of drug treatment to somebody who's an addict, or, you know, abusing somebody having a mental health crisis. There are other people, or just traffic stops. That's where a lot of these killings happen. You can have an unarmed force that just, you know, gives people tickets for running lights or speeding or, you know, not having a license plate or whatever it is. When the guns get involved and you get these cops with attitudes, with departments that police themselves, then you've got a mix of trouble. And defunding, same thing. I don't think it's a good slogan at the grassroots. But you can talk about moving the money. You know, don't have the cops deal with the addicts. Get them drug treatment. Put the money into that. Build some homes instead of harassing the homeless and so forth. So I think, but the core demand has to be community control, because then it would work for us. You would have a board that's elected or even selected by a lot, like a jury, that hires and fires the police chief. It sets the budgets and policies and can independently investigate and discipline officers. So it's outside the department, just like it is for us. I mean, we do something and get charged. We don't go to our club or, you know, our own organization and have them, you know, render, you know, a verdict on us. But that's what the police do. It's crazy. So we got to have independent community control, and the police work for us to the extent we need them. And we got a lot more than we need. Somebody put in the chat that our police budgets in the United States are larger than all the military budgets in the world, except the United States and China. And we have more prisoners than any country in history. We have the largest prison system in the history of the world. You know, there's a lot that needs to change. But back to the revolutionary socialist question, we got to change how policing is governed. It has to be controlled by us, the people, in our own communities. The Panther referendum in Berkeley, they broke it, the Berkeley Police Department, into three sections, one in the Black community in the flats, one in the student university downtown area, which is more mixed, and one in the more white community up in the hills. So then you would have, like they used to say, we need juries of our peers. I mean, that's another thing. I live in a city where the jury pool is from the county, which is predominantly white. The cities have people of color. You go out in the towns in the county, the juries are pulled from those towns. You know, there's a glaring example of institutional racism. But I'll stop there. I can go on. Let's see if we got another question. Yeah, James Campbell. Wall Street bankers' gentrification enabled by the police and sheriff's associations across the U.S. A Ralph Nader moment again. So I guess he's asking for a comment, Ernesto.
Gentrification, well, I mean, yeah, that's something that, you know, I think I get the comment a bit, you know, and at least in regards to our community, or probably as well the African community, one of the first things they did to enable gentrification was the gang injunctions, because with the gang injunctions, the sheriffs or the police, the LAPD, or, you know, wherever, you know, whichever neighborhood or city this was in, they had excuses to put extra fear into people, you know, and justify, you know, extreme paramilitary tactics by saying that they're cracking down on you know, these gangs. You know, obviously we're not saying we want crime, but that's not the solution to this phenomena in our neighborhoods, where young men and women, you know, they look for family and identity because they're denied it, you know, for generations and generations. And they look for it where it's easiest to be found in the neighborhood with each other. But the police, they criminalize our youth this way, you know, and they're the ones that, you know, allow drugs. They're the ones that allow, you know, guns to come into our neighborhoods. And then they use that as an excuse to crack down on us and fracture our community, fracture the barrio, you know. And they made it easier for gentrification doing that, because then you've had people, for example, here in Pacoima and San Fernando, which is part of Los Angeles, you like, for example, our community, there was people that had to go to Palmdale and Antelope Valley, which is out in the desert, because they couldn't live in the city anymore. They were forced to. This caused, you know, more you know, families to leave. And, you know, obviously that's properties that are now open to rent, to sell, to all this stuff. And, you know, these the banks and, you know, these other people, these forces from outside take advantage of that. And that's what they wanted all along, you know, because they no longer have this element that scared people from the outside from even coming in. That's gone, you know. I think that that's sort of what the comment is, and that's what I get from the comment, you know, and I have seen it that way.
Yeah, I think we got the police we got because that's what the real estate industry wants.
Yeah.
They enforce the new Jim Crow.
Yeah.
You know, they enable gentrification and displacement because the real estate industry makes money by scaring the white folks to sell cheap and then selling high to the people of color moving in. And then they make money again when the white folks buy, you know, a McMansion way out in the exurbs. And so it's about money. And I think the reference to, and that's what, you know, you don't have police abusing people most of the time in these, you know, small towns and suburbs. You have small police departments. You have more of the officer-friendly kind of scenario, as opposed to the stop and frisk and harass policing you get in the urban communities. And then I think Ralph Nader, when I see Ralph Nader's name mentioned there, I think of one thing he always points out is that corporate crime costs us many, many times more than street crime. You know, that's what rips us off, you know, payday loans, rent to buy, cash checking operations, and, you know, medical billing. I mean, there's so much fraud and abuse of the average person getting ripped off by corporate criminals. And in the case of real estate, you know, the Fair Housing Act passed in 1968, and we're more segregated now than we were then. So, you know, that's, I think, what he means by, at least what I think when he says a Ralph Nader moment. And it also makes me think there's a book that people should read about this segregation in the real estate industry by Richard Rothstein called The Color of Law. And he shows how, you know, they say there's de jure segregation where it's in the law, and then there's de facto segregation where it's not. You read that book, you realize that so-called de facto segregation has been enforced by the state, by the police, by the different kinds of contracts they have on who can buy homes that have been grandfathered in for years, and by a judicial system that makes it hard as hell to prosecute discrimination in the housing market. So I recommend that book. Gene Lowe's Pascalides. Decriminalization of drugs will reduce the size of the police force, as they would not be arresting users.
That's actually interesting, because one of the things, you know, out here in California, probably other states as well, you know, that I've heard, you know, now with like states decriminalizing marijuana, is that, you know, there's probably thousands and thousands of people in jail because of marijuana, and they're still in jail, you know, and disproportionately, you know, black and brown people in jail because of that. But now, you know, marijuana is being decriminalized in a lot of states, but these people are still in there. You know, that's a travesty. That's, you know, travesty of justice, you know, but it kind of, you know, it shows us, you know, where the interests are, you know, the interest is to put people in jail, is to put people in prison. Cause it's one, it's a way of control. And two, it's a way of profiting off of basically slave labor in these dungeons. They're dungeons, you know, and we see it, you know, I mean, again, you know, I can only give examples that I see in my life, you know, here in the San Fernando Valley where I live, you know, the Northeast is the, you know, is mostly working class, Chicano, there's a African-American presence. And then you have the other side of the valley, the West Valley, which is, you know, the more wealthy area, the one, you know, that's, you see more in the movies and stuff like that with Encino or Ventura Boulevard and all that. You know, both areas have crime. Both areas have drug abuse. Both areas have domestic violence. Both areas have, you know, drunk driving and alcoholism, stuff like that. But there's only one of those areas that sees, you know, a intense police, well, I guess brutality, but, you know, intense policing, basically, you know, with almost every weekend we get the retenes right here, you know, the where they stop and they you know, they check everybody, you know, that's driving by. They stop them. They ask you for your license and registration and all that, you know, with the excuse that they're catching drunk drivers. Before it was that they were catching unlicensed drivers. And so obviously that's straight up they're picking at our people, because a lot of our people are undocumented, you know. But now it's that they're trying to stop drunk driving. Obviously, we don't want drunk drivers. We don't want that, but that's their excuse. We don't see them doing that as much over there. You know, I grew up seeing the police, you know, I was telling someone this the other day, you know, busting down people's doors armed to the teeth and then saying, oh, we're sorry, wrong house, or it was a mistake. I had a friend on the street behind where I grew up, where my parents live right now still. This one night, I remember the helicopter all night long. And then the next day, he told us that the police, LAPD, the Foothill Division, the one that beat up Rodney King, they came to their house and they accused that someone had run in there and that they were, you know, holding him there, like protecting him. They brought out his grandmother, you know, his sisters, his parents. They had him outside all night long, starting from like 3 in the morning till like 8 in the morning. He obviously was upset, you know, and so they accused him of being violent. They tackled him. They hogtied him. They threw him behind the squad car, and they had him hogtied in that manner for hours up until the morning when they let him go. And what happened? They said, "Oh, we're sorry. We had the wrong house." I mean, these are things that happen all the time here in the barrio, in the ghetto, you know, working class communities. They don't happen over there. You know, we never hear about police knocking down doors and dragging out people and beating people up and, you know, having them outside in the cold, having elderly people outside in the cold and accusing them of stuff that they haven't done, whether they've done it or not. That doesn't happen in Encino or Calabasas or any of those places. You know, we don't have, the same policing over there as we do here in the barrio. Or, you know, so, and what is that? Again, that's, you know, because our community serves as like a trowel, you know, where the pigs eat out of, you know, a perfect comparison, the pigs, you know, where they eat out of, you know, and they use us at their will. If they need more people to, you know, fill their quotas for tickets or arrests or whatever, just come to the barrio. If they need more people, you know, in the prisons and jails, just come to the barrio. Get some of those Mexicans, get some of those Chicanos, get some of those Black people, get some of those homeless people and shove them in there, you know, fill up your quota, you know. So, yeah, I mean, that's one of the realities that we face.
Garrett Brown, how do we address the problem of fascist hiring and training of police officers by contractors?
Well, I mean, I would say that's something, if this is a police department in the United States, that's something that's always going to be there, you know. And again, I mean, we have to understand what the exact role of the police is. And it's not to, you know, serve justice. It's not to, you know, enforce just laws and adjust and humane social and economic structure. The role of the police is to enforce the will of the people in power, you know. So that's always going to be a problem. So again, I think, you know, and I think Brother Howie, he gave a perfect example earlier about community policing, and that was the Black Panther Party. The Black Panther Party is a perfect example, because that was the people themselves. In this case, obviously African people, but they inspired others. You know, they inspired Puerto Ricanos, they inspired Chicanos, they inspired AIM, you know, or the American Indian movement, our native people on the reservations. They inspired them, you know, as you know, they were a party. First and foremost, they were a party, a political party, revolutionary political party. But, you know, one of the one of their projects that we see most is how they had community policing. And just the fact that, you know, a lot of them were very organized and armed, they filled the role of an actual police force in the ghetto, you know, and that's why they came under attack, you know, because they were successful at doing that. And this kind of reminds me, you know, because, you know, my time in the unions, you know, there would be places, you know, where the workers already had a contract, you know, sometimes very good contracts, but their contracts were always getting violated by the boss, by the company, whatever, et cetera. You know, and sometimes individual workers, right, they would be like, you know, what can we do? We have a contract, we have a union, nothing happens. Well, I mean, the problem there, you know, is that nobody was enforcing the contract. The workers, even though they were unionized, they were still disorganized. So, you know, that kind of, I think, it mirrors what outside in society we have to do as well. You know, we can't depend on you know, the boss or those in power, the politicians in power, to, you know, do good things. We have to be organized. Because if we're not organized, let's say there's some law that is beneficial, nobody's going to enforce it. You know, there's something that's right or something's beneficial to our communities, nobody's going to enforce it. There's an interest, you know, whatever interest we might have, if we're not organized, if we don't have our own parties, if we don't have our own organizations, then nobody's going to enforce it. The people in power do not respect anything but power, you know, and I think that's what I see. I mean, because, you know, police officers in the United States, this is the same story. I mean, we could rewind the tape and hear this in 1992 after, you know, the Rodney King verdict. The same thing, you know, and people after, you know, the rebellion, the LA rebellion, there was, you know, other rebellions throughout the country at the same time, but it was mostly Los Angeles, so a lot of people were hopeful that, you know, now they're going to get it. And the police politicians were saying that, you know, like, oh, now things are going to be different. You know, we're going to revise this policy. We're going to pass this policy. We're going to change this here. And police officers, we need more black and brown police officers. And that really didn't do a thing, with all due respect, a goddamn thing. You know, it just made the person that beats you or shoots you brown or black. That's it. Or a woman. That's it. They're still police officers. They're still, you know, upholding the same unjust social structure, you know. So unless we're organized as communities, as a people, as workers, as students, as, you know, all the different strata in society, unless we're organized and we have, you know, parties that are going to struggle for our interests, you know, then these things are going to keep happening.
Yeah, we have a big problem of the far right, the white supremacists, the neo-Nazis, recruiting police officers and infiltrating police departments. It's well documented. And for me, that comes back to community control, because then we can vet everybody. We can look at who they are. And we had that example, I guess it's a couple of years ago now, of that Facebook page where there were thousands of Border Patrol members on there saying all kinds of racist and misogynistic things about the mostly Mexican and Central American immigrants coming across the border. You know, that department needs to be they need to fire everybody and then hire a new force and vet everybody coming in. We can do that in our communities if we get control of the police department. And the contractors are a big problem. It's a whole industry. There's so much money going to police, they got to spend it. So they hire these firms that set up to consult. And we had notorious cases, particularly, you know, about a decade ago, where these right-wing Islamophobic consultants who basically told them every Muslim is a terrorist. I mean, that may be oversimplification, but that was the message these officers were getting. So to me, it comes back to community control. If they're not working for us and they're working for themselves or the power structure behind them, we're still going to have the same problems. And we're going to have these, you know, fascists, neo-Nazis, and racists in the police departments. Saul Oias, hopefully I pronounced that correctly. What can we do about the absent father that is a sad norm in this country and around the world? That bothers me, affects me personally. I cannot be quiet about that. Our kids deserve better.
That's a fine. I mean, I kind of think I know what that comment means. Again, you know, if we go to Encino, if we go to some of these other communities that are wealthier, that are whiter, there's absent fathers there, but their children are not being thrown into prisons or jails or murdered. What can we do about absent fathers? Well, and again, in our community, stop throwing them in prisons and jails. You know, let families have healthy lives. You know, part of that is that we live in a capitalist economy that doesn't allow people to have healthy relationships, doesn't let people have a living wage. I mean, that's just a big thing. I mean, I'll give another example here. You know, I mean, there used to be a GM plant here in Van Nuys. It was a very big plant. You know, it closed back in the, I believe, late 80s, early 90s, sometime back then. Then there was another one here in Pacoima. It was called Price Pfister, where they make pipe. They used to make pipe fittings. That one closed in 1995. You know, those were hard jobs, you know, working class jobs, but they were unionized, and people could have raise a family out of that. What do we have there today? McDonald's, Lowe's, you know, Panda Express, you know, part-time, minimum wage, non-unionized jobs. How do we expect families to be able to raise themselves healthily, you know, have everything that they need, getting paid, you know, having part-time minimum wage work, and you know, rent and mortgages, you know, are extreme. You know, how can we expect people to live healthy lives, to develop healthy families, if, you know, this basic human need is not being met? And then, you know, some tragedy happens, and what do they say? They blame it on a kid not having a father. Obviously, you know, that might play an immediate role, but that's not where the problem arises out of. You know, if you go to other communities that don't get treated this way, you have all the same ills, but you don't have the state coming down on them like they do on us, and then, you know, making these excuses about, you know, oh, it's a cultural thing. You know, where have we heard that before? Where have we heard that, you know, the problems facing Chicanos and Black people and other, you know, quote unquote people of color is a cultural problem? You know, we've heard that before from somebody else. And you know, yes, those are racist talking points. That's not where the problem is. But, you know, If people can't feed their families, if they can't have a roof over their family, over, you know, for their families, provide what basic necessities for their families, then you're gonna have, you know, the family structure fall apart. If you have over policing that targets Chicanos, that targets Puerto Ricanos, that targets, you know, Native American people, that indigenous people, that targets Africans, the targets poor people and rips our families apart, you know, sending, you know, I mean, it is the biggest prison industrial complex in the entire world. So it's a complex, it's an industry that does that to families. You know, we're going to have all sorts of problems, you know, so that's what we could do. We need to face the reality, you know, and stop thinking, you know, these issues are down to a cultural thing, or, you know, all this, you know, the kid didn't have a father. You know, that's something obviously we don't want to happen, but, you know, the problem, that's not the problem. That's a result of the problem.
Yeah, I would say the cultural aspiration in these communities is to have whole families with fathers present. And the prison system is ripping these fathers away disproportionately in the exploited and oppressed communities. And when you add to that economic hardship, that stresses families, you know, and leads to more divorce or more men just, you know, leaving to go find work or leaving because they feel like they're not pulling up their end of the bargain. All that, you know, contributes to that. But the culture in these communities is, yeah, we're going to have a regular family. That's what people aspire to. So to say they got a bad culture is just nonsense. Zeke Kramer, in your opinion, does the United States still engage in modern colonialism?
Yes, of course. That is what the United States, that's the way it exists. It started by colonizing, you know, our people, but on the East Coast, our native family over there, it massacred millions of people. And when they didn't have any more workers or workers that they could exploit as much, that's when they went to Africa and brought people from Africa and made them slaves. They didn't bring slaves; they made people slaves, and then, you know, they continued going west, Manifest Destiny, and they invaded Mexico, and that's how they got the Southwest, and they colonized, you know, the all these groups, you know, that I just mentioned are colonized people, you know, and then they continued on to the Pacific Islands. Hawaii is another colonized nation, group of people, indigenous group of people. You know, that's probably the main contradiction in the United States. If you ask me, is the fact that, you know, the United States is not one nation, is not one group of people, but it's one dominating settler nation sitting on top of the land and the labor of several other colonized and oppressed nations. You know, because that's the relationship we have with the United States. You know, that's why we've had to organize our own organizations as Chicanos, La Raza Unida, the Brown Berets, the Mecha, even United Farm Workers, or all these other, because the dominant society does not reflect our interests, never has and never will, because the interest that the dominant society has with us is to, one, they took our land, and two, keep taking our labor. And you know, that's the relationship we have with it. You know, for example, again, you know, in the daytime, you know, people in our community, you know, they go work somewhere, they come back home, and at night, whoever they work for takes a big bag of money. Or, I mean, they don't literally take a big bag of money, but, you know, and they go, they leave from here. You know, that the wealth created from the work of these laborers, you know, Chicano, Mexicano, undocumented, or you know, here for generations, the wealth that they created working doesn't stay here. It goes somewhere else. And every institution that comes into our neighborhoods isn't controlled by the community itself. You know, the schools, you know, the schools don't reflect the community. The schools don't reflect, you know, the history of the community or the area where they're in. They don't. Why is that? Because they need to, you know, a colonial system needs to churn out people that don't know anything about themselves and are thinking that they need to identify with their captor, and they're easier to manipulate that way, you know, in all aspects. So yes, the United States only exists because of colonialism and neocolonialism, you know, where they put these, they put these brown politicians, these brown business owners or black, these brown policemen, and they try to make us think, oh, everything's okay now because look, they're brown like you. Well, you know, this guy's last name is Becerra, like you. You know, or Padilla or Alarcón or whatever, you know, and those people are still upholding somebody else's interests, only that the people doing that, they're brown like us, or they have named in Spanish or et cetera, you know, or they speak Spanish. So yes, you know, the United States is a colonizer. Definitely is.
And I would just add, internationally, yeah, you know, we don't take over a country and call it our colony, but we install leaders with military force or covert action, and we use our big corporations and banks to dominate them economically into accepting trade policies and domestic austerity policies and access to their markets and their resources. So, you know, what when they put the, you know, the black face or the brown face to administer the ghetto or the barrio, they do the same thing in these countries. You know, they have local leaders, you know, are from that nation, but they don't represent that nation. They represent the colonialists or the neocolonialists. And that's a big struggle going on right now, say in Haiti, where we're backing a guy that his term of office is over and he's ruling by decree. And the United States says it supports democracy. Chris Hedges just had an article and he pointed out that since World War II, we've been involved in all these military interventions and covert actions. And how many democracies have we left behind? He said none. I was thinking you could maybe argue Japan, and after a while, South Korea became democracy. Japan started during the occupation after World War II. But, you know, that's not what happened, say, in Honduras, where they grabbed the president Zelaya in his pajamas and threw him out of the country one morning. And then they called it a constitutional transition. And that was backed by Clinton in the State Department and the Obama administration. And now it's a narco state, total disaster. You know, they murdered the indigenous people who try to defend their land and their environment. And then we wonder why they want to come to the United States. They have no future there, particularly after these last two hurricanes that just, you know, really wiped out what little people had. So Honduras is a neo-colony. And, you know, we could go all over the world and analyze what's going on.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I always found that, in the news, you know, right now, within, you know, from the Trump administration to now, you had they're always been scapegoating, you know, Central American people, Haitian people, when 10 years ago they overthrew their democratically elected governments. And historically, they've overthrown their democratically elected governments or armed, you know, brutal thugs and dictators in you know, Papa Doc in Haiti, or the Somozas in Nicaragua, and then the Contras, you know, or the all the, you know, brutal dictatorships in El Salvador and Guatemala that massacred hundreds of thousands of people. And, you know, then these people, you know, they're human beings. They're gonna, you know, look for a better life somewhere if they can't find it where they're at, you know, and they migrate up north because of the United States, because of what the United States does to them. And then the United States, which needs their labor, by the way, trashes them and scapegoats them and drags them all, you know, through hell. You know, that's what they're doing right now to you know, these people. There are our people, you know. I mean, I'm Chicano, but this is still my people, you know. Even if they're not, you know, Mexican descent or born here or whatever, that's still my people, you know. They're indigenous people. And, you know, they're throwing them in these cages. And you know, that wouldn't even – if these were, you know, suburban white mothers and kids, which obviously we wouldn't want to see that either, but being thrown into cages and – basically jails for kids and people like that migrating, this would never happen, you know. But because it's, you know, poor brown people, poor indigenous people, it, you know, it kind of just slips by, and it's okay, you know. And the current administration basically does the same as the last, but with a smile on their face and not using basically as much dog whistles as that other fool did. And it's okay, you know. It's not okay. It's a travesty. It's a human rights violation, and we should be opposed to it completely.
So Ernesto, we're running out of time here. Is there any other ideas, thoughts you want to share with people before we close it up?
Well, you know, thank you for having me on, brothers and sisters. You know, yeah, I mean, let's just you know, see history unfolding before our eyes. And let's remember, you know, again, I really want to stress that, you know, that this verdict would not have happened had it not been for last year's, you know, fiery summer, you know, for that, because that's what they saw. That's what they fear. They fear the people in the streets and taking matters into their own hands. They saw the power in that. They saw the danger to the status quo in that. You know, they don't want that to happen again. And it's unfortunately, you know, in a system like this, it will eventually happen again. But they don't want that to happen again, because that was helping people raise their mind, their consciousness, and look to alternatives to the Democrats and Republicans. You know, and they definitely do not want that. You know, so I mean, if I could leave something, you know, it would be, you know, for people to you know, take that as they say, food for thought. You know, the power is in the people. You know, anything that has changed and has been beneficial to the people, to the common woman and man, et cetera, has come from the people themselves. You know, so hopefully this is a clear indication of that. Hopefully we recall that and we use that energy to continue organizing. You know, let's not let this, you know, we have, you know, because what they want is for us to say the same thing that they want with, you know, having gotten Biden in office. Everything's okay. Go back to regular life. You know, don't organize. Don't think outside of what we tell you you should think. You know, let's keep organizing. Let's keep, you know, having these discussions and presentations and you know, and talking about, you know, socialism and you know, what real alternatives are for the people, by the people. Thank you.
Thank you, Ernesto. You know, my closing thought is, you know, you're right. Biden is not the answer. And you talked about, you know, he's sort of a smiley face on the same old system. Last Friday, after promising to raise the refugee cap from 15,000 to 125,000, he said he's going to keep Trump's cap of 15,000. In a world with more refugees than any time since World War II, over 80 million displaced people. So even 125,000 is a drop in the bucket, considering that, you know, U.S. interventions abroad, Afghanistan, Syria, Central America, is part of the reason why a lot of people are displaced and on the move. So, but what happened was he got pushed back immediately. So by the end of Friday, he was saying, well, I'm going to announce a number in, I think it's May 1st. So, you know, he's the smiley face, but he can be moved. So that's just to encourage people, you know, don't get resigned. Speak up, stand up, keep pushing. And the system is strong, but it's not immovable. So the other thing I just want to tell people, and it partly, and I saw some of the comments in the chat that were thinking nuclear power is a carbon-free thing we can build quickly. And now, next week, we're going to be talking with two anti-nuclear activists, Harvey Wasserman, who I've known since 1976 when we formed the Clamshell Alliance back in New Hampshire to fight nuclear power. And we had a lot of success. And Marilyn Ellie, who has been one of the key activists in the shutdown of the Indian Point nukes, which are within striking distance of New York City. So I urge people to join us next week. You know, Biden is pro-nuclear. I don't get me started, because that's next week's program. But that is not a solution. So we'll be talking about that next week. So everybody stay safe. COVID, new variants. You know, we're in a third or fourth wave. You know, even some people get vaccinated, but they still get one of these new variants. So, you know, take care of yourself. Take the precautions and be safe. And have a good evening.